And first of all, today we have with us Brad Smith. He's the managing member of Arnold & Smith PLLC, based in Charlotte. Brad was born and raised right here in Charlotte, attending Charlotte Country Day, and then going on to NC State and Mercer in Atlanta for law school. And following law school, Brad worked for the Mecklenburg County District Attorney's Office, prosecuting both felony and misdemeanor cases until 2006. And then he left the public sector and entered private practice. In 2007, Brad and Matt Arnold, another Charlotte native, founded Arnold & Smith PLLC. And since going into private practice, Brad has focused his private practice primarily on DWI and criminal defense work, as well as appellate and personal injury cases. And during his nearly 10 years as an attorney, he's been awarded numerous honors, including back-to-back National Trial Lawyers Association Top 100 Trial Lawyers and Top 40 Under 40 Awards. In 2013, he was voted the best lawyer in Charlotte by the Charlotte Observer's Reader's Choice publication. Brad, we're so glad to have you with us here this morning on the Legal Forum. And first of all, we'd like to ask you, what are the most common mistakes people make when being stopped by a police officer?
Well, Brant, thanks for having me, first off. Most common mistakes people make, I think probably the most common mistake somebody makes is when a police officer pulls them over, they're under the immediate impression that they have to do everything an officer asked. Everything, in other words, if an officer asks them to blow into a machine that they don't want to blow into, to make some sort of admission that they don't want to, it's when you're pulled over on the side of the road, you're not under arrest, you're just being temporarily detained, so to speak, so an officer can conduct some sort of investigation on you.
Okay, and if a person is arrested, what should they expect after being put in the back of the police car?
Well, I guess the first thing they should expect is they're going to go to jail. But if we're talking in the context of being arrested for driving while impaired, what they can expect is they're going to be taken down to the police station, and they're going to be asked to blow into the breath instrument that the state of North Carolina uses. It's called the Intoxilizer ECIR2. So they're going to be asked to submit to a test of their breath.
Okay, and what should a person do or not do if they are arrested?
Well, the most difficult part about a driving while impaired case is that you're asked to blow into this machine, the Intoxilizer ECIR2. It's the only really type of forensic evidence in our justice system that I can think of, where the piece of evidence, when you blow into the breathalyzer, your breath test isn't saved. It's not put into property control. It's not taken somewhere where at a later date, if you don't trust the reading that the machine produced, that you can go and retest your breath sample to see what your actual breath concentration was. So your only ability really to rebut a breath test is to get out of jail within some reasonable period of time and go and obtain your own test. So if you've been drinking, if you've been arrested for driving while impaired, probably presumably it's because you've already submitted to a roadside breath test of some sort that's ultimately not admissible in court. And probably your smartest thing to do at that point is to probably not blow into the breath test machine. I think a lot of people think that, you know, a lot of clients I have, when I ask them why did they blow into this instrument that they don't know anything about, generally what they have to say is, well, because the police officer asked me. And again, just because the officer asked you to do that, it's not necessarily something you're required to do. In fact, it's not something you're required to do at all. And the biggest trouble with breath testing is again, as I said, it's your ability to rebut that test. It prints out a receipt, and that's generally the only thing that the state uses when prosecuting you to show that you're guilty of the offense. So your question was, what can you expect? Well, you expect to be asked to blow into a breath test machine, and is it the best thing always to blow into the machine? And the answer generally to that is no.
Okay, and I guess one of the things that we also need to ask you, Brad, is what kind of penalties are associated with being convicted of DWI?
DWI sentencing ranges, if it's your first DWI, if you didn't have a child in the car, if you don't have, a prior driving while impaired conviction, if you didn't hurt somebody, if your driver's license wasn't suspended for DWI, those list of things I just went through are what are called grossly aggravating factors. So DWI sentencing is based on the presence of grossly aggravating factors, or what are called aggravating factors. Now, if you have a grossly aggravating factor, again, child, prior DWI within 7 years, license suspended for DWI, then you're looking at a mandatory minimum active sentence of 7 days if you have one grossly aggravating factor. And this gets boring and sort of technical, but if you have two grossly aggravating factors that are present, then you're looking at a mandatory minimum sentence of 30 days, and it sort of goes on from there. But usually the most common situation is you're getting a DWI, it's your first offense, and traditionally it's what's called a level 5 sentencing. Sentencing is, it goes from the most lenient sentence being a level 5 all the way down to level 1 being, of course, the most severe sentence. And a level 5 sentence is usually a judge is required to sentence you at a mandatory minimum of at least 24 hours in jail, but that 24 hours in jail can be substituted for 24 hours of community service. So if you, along with that usually is a period of some sort of form of probation, and then you're generally required to go and obtain an alcohol substance abuse assessment and then comply with whatever the recommendations of the substance abuse assessment would be, what their recommendations as far as hours of treatment. And then lastly, which is usually the most severe thing, or the thing people don't like the most if they get convicted of DWI for a first offense, is you lose your driver license for 1 year. Now, if you've gotten, as I said, a prior driving while impaired conviction, if you've had a prior offense within 7 years, then you lose your license for 4 years. And then it goes up from there until you reach what's called a permanent license suspension. So in North Carolina, if you find yourself sort of as a repeat offender in this sort of area, then North Carolina has the right to do what's called instituting a permanent revocation of your driver's license.
Okay, I just thought of this question, Brad. It's not really on the list here, but do the judges, as a criteria, can age be a factor in the type of sentence that a judge imposes? Say, for instance, a young person who is under the legal drinking age who is caught with DWI, would the judge be harsher on him than he would be on maybe a middle-aged person who has a first offense?
Brant, traditionally, number one, I guess you don't, doing this about every day, you don't see a lot of older drivers, I guess, a lot of times getting driving while impaired charges. Is there per se a provision in the law that says if you're younger, your sentence is going to be greater, it's going to be harsher than if you're an older driver? And the answer to that is no. Now, along with those grossly aggravating factors I just told you about, the law has what's called mitigating factors. Now, age is not, if you're an older driver, age is not a catch-all mitigating factor, but the court has the ability under its discretion. There's sort of a catch-all mitigating factor, and it says, whatever circumstance may tend to mitigate the offense. So if you're an older driver, if you're, somebody that's, 65 or above, and you've driven your entire life with a safe driving record and have never had any sort of offense like this, or you're not somebody that's habitually speeding or getting charged with reckless driving, I imagine that your age and, it could be something that could factor into sentencing. Now, one of the mitigating factors that you tend to commonly see is a person submitting in the sentencing hearing a driving record that is what's categorized as a safe driving record under law, and that means there aren't any 4-point violations on your driving record within the last 10 years. So that's a mitigating factor as well, something that can mitigate the sentence.
Okay, and we do want to ask you this, Brad. We've talked about the different situations as far as losing the license and things like that, but what are some of the other costs that a person might expect to pay when we talk about fees and court costs, insurance premiums, and possibly having an interlock ignition device of some sort?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing that just a typical DWI conviction costs you is money. It costs you money in court fine. It costs you money in court costs, which are now $180. Over the decade or so I've been doing this, I think when I started, court costs were around $75, and then they've greatly increased over the last 10 years to now where they are at $180. A judge has the ability to institute a fine on you. That fine can be substantial. It can go over $1,000. But the biggest cost that this leads to for motorists is a drastic increase in their insurance premiums. Now, their insurance surcharge rate, rather. North Carolina Department of Insurance regulates all companies that sell insurance in North Carolina, specifically automobile insurance. And the insurance regulations tell an insurance company, based on a point system, how much they can raise a person's insurance surcharge based on a driving while impaired conviction. If you get a DWI, your insurance company has the ability to raise your rate 400% for a 3-year period of time. It's called the experience period. So what the biggest thing a DWI charge is going to cost you is going to hit you in your pocketbook, because when you go to apply for an insurance policy, because you've got the driving while impaired conviction on it, they have the ability to raise your rate, and that rate change generally would be somewhere around a 400% rate increase.
Okay, and I'd like to remind everybody that you're listening to The Legal Forum. My name is Brant Hart, and right now I'm talking with Brad Smith from Arnold and Smith. And Brad, I believe you're located at 200 North McDowell Street in the John Price Car House. And what's a phone number where people can reach you if they need your particular service?
Brant, our office number is 704-370-2828. Our web address is www.arnoldsmithlaw.com.
Okay, and the next question would be, what should a person expect to pay for a good attorney to handle a DWI situation?
Well, Brant, I know what I charge, and generally what I charge for a driving while impaired charge, and I think the biggest thing to say is legal fees are, it's not like going out and buying a television. You go in and there's a Sony on the wall or a Panasonic, and this is what they cost, because lawyers' legal fees are based on time. And every case that comes into the office, I guess the most exciting thing about it, what I do is no case is the same. So you usually, when you're coming in to talk to a lawyer, the first thing you should never do, or I always say, is you should never hire a lawyer over the telephone. You should always usually come in, sit down across the table from them, and speak to them directly, because you've got to remember that the person that's going to be representing you in any sort of matter is generally the person that's going to be speaking for you, and the person that is representing you in court, that's representing you out of court. And I think probably the most responsible thing to do before you ask somebody to do something like that is to sit down and speak with them face to face to make sure you're comfortable with them taking on that role. Along with that sort of meeting comes the attorney or my ability to assess sort of the time commitment that the case is going to take, and that's generally how you assess a legal fee. So it's generally not something where I can say that it costs this amount of money. Because each case is different. Each case requires a different sort of time commitment, and the fairest way to approach that is to sit down with somebody, assess their case, talk with them, see what their expectations are, see what they want to do, and then you usually assign a fee based on that discussion.
Okay, Brad, and of course the next question that we have here, and this will certainly certainly important here because of the fact that even though we're right here in Charlotte, we have a lot of listeners in South Carolina because a lot of our listeners live in the Rock Hill, Fort Mill area based on where our radio tower is. So what I need to ask next is, are DWI cases the same county to county and state to state? What might be different in South Carolina for our Rock Hill listeners than what our Charlotte listeners might have to deal with?
Well, the answer to that question is that when you're in the state of North Carolina, the DWI laws are the exact same from county to county. It's a state law. So whether you get charged with driving while impaired in Mecklenburg County or Gaston County or Lincoln County, the law is the same. The judges and the prosecutors are going to be different. And the way in which the judges sometimes view the law and the way in which the prosecutors prosecute the law, and of course the most frequently the way in which the judges sentence on the law does change from county to county. And it's generally based on sort of the easiest way to say it is the political ideology in general of the county. Now, South Carolina's DWI laws are different than North Carolina. South Carolina's DWI laws are actually substantially different. But the biggest difference is that when you're charged with something like this in South Carolina, and I'm not licensed to practice law in South Carolina, but just based on speaking with lawyers down there and having clients that, of course, face this charge in South Carolina, when you get charged with a traffic-related offense, which driving while impaired, or DUI, as I believe it's called in South Carolina, is a traffic offense. In South Carolina, you go into magistrate's court, and in magistrate's court, there's not a solicitor that's assigned to the courtroom. There's a magistrate judge, and the officer that has charged you with the offense actually takes on the duty of prosecuting you as well as being essentially the chief witness or the chief investigator in the case, which is a very sort of unique circumstance. Now, in South Carolina, if you hire an attorney, or even if you don't, you can ask for a hearing or a trial in their state-level trial court, and that would be where a jury is placed into a box, and you'd have a full hearing on the record. But the largest distinction between North and South Carolina is the fact that you're the court of original jurisdiction for a DUI case is a magistrate's court, where there's actually not even a prosecutor handling the case.
Okay, we do appreciate you giving us that information, and I'm sure if any of our South Carolina listeners needed someone in that particular area to help them, that they could get in touch with you, and you could probably help them find an attorney to help them in South Carolina.
Certainly, yes.
All right, another question here, and I think a lot of people would wonder about this. Do I have the right to record the interaction with the officer?
Yeah, you absolutely do. And it's funny because a lot of people sort of are under the impression that unless you have the permission of a police officer to record an interaction, that you can't do it. Now, we're moving in a direction, fortunately, where police officers have videos inside their automobiles. They've got microphones on their utility belt that the hope is that they would always record any sort of interaction that you're having. The reality of the situation is usually, even despite this technology, it's amazing how many times you go into court and that video wasn't working or it wasn't turned on, and that's usually the excuse. The biggest thing you'll find that a lot of times keeps any sort of criminal investigation honest is your ability to record exactly what's happening out there. You don't ever usually want to be put in a situation, and under any circumstance, where it's your word against another person, or frankly, where it's your word against a police officer's word. We all now have these phones, smartphones, most people that have cameras and have video recorders on it. And I always tell people, don't be afraid to use them. I mean, don't be afraid to take it out and record the interaction. I don't think it's being rude. I don't think you're suggesting that you're trying to catch somebody in some sort of bad circumstance. But recording an interaction is the easiest way to keep the interaction honest. Because if you ever have to go back and say, well, this is what happened, you're not having to rely on just your word. You have the ability to rely on an actual live recording with sound, as well as, you know, at least my phone or most smartphones have the ability to actually record like a camcorder. So, I encourage people all the time to not be bashful about recording interaction. I think that's a that's something that, that people should certainly do when they're faced with any sort of interaction with law enforcement.
Okay, Brad, and the next question, and I think a lot of people are really interested to know this particular one. Am I required to submit to field sobriety test or the intoxilizer alco-sensor breath test, or can I refuse to participate in any testing?
Brant, I think the most intriguing part of representing people charged with driving while impaired is an officer's investigation is usually tailored to observations that he makes of your person when you're doing field sobriety tests or you're getting out of an automobile or you're just generally talking with them and interacting with them. The most common things you hear when you come into court is the first thing is the officer making a comment about how somebody is talking. Now, I think the most important thing to say is when you're pulled over and a police officer comes up and starts investigating you for driving while impaired, it's usually because he smells an odor of alcohol in your breath. Now, if you've been drinking alcohol and the person that you're speaking to hasn't, if you can think about the last time you talked to us with somebody that may have had a drink and you hadn't drank anything, you can smell what's generally on their breath. And that doesn't mean just because you smell alcohol on their breath that they're a drunk driver. When a police officer comes up to a car, he's usually talking with somebody that he's never spoken to before. He doesn't know how they talk. He is usually asking somebody to step out of the car that he doesn't know what their athletic ability is or what their health is or if they've got trouble with their knees or their legs or their back. So you're being asked to perform essentially these dexterity tests, and the officer is going to be sort of picking different things that he observes, and he uses those as his basis to place you under arrest. And when you go into court and you watch a DWI trial in action, you never ever hear a police officer testifying about all the good things that you did. It's generally picking out very specific things that he would claim was a bad thing. For instance, the three standardized field sobriety tests that are used in North Carolina, there's only three verified standardized field sobriety tests. When I say verified, the Department of Transportation has verified them for their accuracy, and that's standing on one leg. It's called the one-leg stand. The walk and turn, it's where it's sort of the most talked about field sobriety test. It's where you stand on a line and then you take nine steps, turn around, and take nine steps back. And then a more scientific test that you see ophthalmologists do a lot, it's called the horizontal gaze and nystagmus test. It's where the officer holds his pen or his finger in front of your face and then ask you to follow this stimulus with your eyes and your eyes only. And with horizontal gaze and nystagmus, he's looking for the presence of what's called eye nystagmus or the popping of your eyes as you follow the stimulus with your eyes. Now, most people, when they're doing the horizontal gaze and nystagmus test, when they come in and talk to you, they say, well, I didn't have any trouble following the stimulus with his eyes. I did that fine. And that he's not testing you for your ability to follow it. He's again looking for this popping in the eyes. Well, there's about 100 different reasons why your eyes can exhibit eye nystagmus, and so that test and that test standing alone generally isn't where an investigation ends. So an officer also asks you usually to stand on this line and then to stand on this line and walk down it, and then also to stand on one leg. Well, the trouble with those tests is. You know, you're not trying out for the Olympic Games. It's not the presidential physical fitness test like you took when you were in high school. You're having an officer make observations or critique you for this test when he doesn't know anything about you. Well, when you're pulled out of a car and you're being asked to do these tests and the ramifications of not necessarily performing them correctly or scoring a perfect score is going to jail, you can also tend to be fairly nervous. So, are you required to do standardized field sobriety tests on the side of the road? You're not. If you refuse probably to do standardized field sobriety tests, the irony of it is that the officer is probably going to take you to jail for refusing to perform his test. So it's always sort of a difficult thing as an attorney to say without knowing anything more about how much the person has had to drink, you know, what their athletic ability is, how they're going to perform on these tests, even when they're sober, to make a judgment call. Is it always intelligent to do standardized field sobriety tests? But what I do tell people, because anybody can find themselves being investigated for DWI if you go to dinner and have a drink. If you go to dinner and have a drink and you get stopped at a checkpoint and an officer smells alcohol on your breath, he's probably going to conduct a driving while impaired investigation on you. And I think what you have to realize when you're out on the side of the road performing tests or being asked to perform tests is making sure that you understand exactly what the officer's instructions are and making sure you exactly understand what the officer's expectations are of you. And if you have any sort of physical deficiencies, you have any sort of medical problems, tell the officer about that. And don't dare perform the test if you do have these sorts of problems, because it's just it simply can lead to you being arrested for something and having your mugshot on an internet and having to go through this horrible process when simply communicating with an officer that these are the issues that I have with my legs, my back, my knees, these are the health issues I have, when that could potentially save you from being arrested at all.
Okay, Brad, looks like we're almost running out of time here, so the one question I guess I should ask before we let you go is, when should I hire an attorney after being charged?
You should hire an attorney after being charged. Probably you should start thinking about the process the day after you're arrested. I think the most important part of an investigation or representing somebody on a criminal offense is the beginning stages. Primarily in DWI litigation is because when you get a DWI in North Carolina, at least, you lose your license on a 30-day civil revocation. Well, your ability to get around North Carolina without a license is very difficult. An attorney that represents people for driving while impaired can get you your license back on what's called a pretrial limited privilege. But the other thing is that your ability to recollect and your ability for friends to recollect what was going on that evening, how people were behaving. The other thing is that in this day and age, when you're representing somebody charged with DWI, video is so, so, so important. And your ability to issue a subpoena to preserve video evidence, your ability to issue a subpoena to preserve radio traffic evidence is essential in representing somebody on an offense like this. Again, I can't say this enough. You're charged with DWI, your ability to gather evidence to keep the police officer honest in court. And when I say that, it's not that saying all police officers come into court and lie, but what I'm saying is that the most honest piece of evidence is always video evidence.
Okay. Thank you very much, Brad. We're out of time for this segment. Thank you again, Brad Smith from Arnold and Smith. You're located at 200 North McDowell Street, and the number there is 704-370-2828. Thank you very much, Brad.
Brant, it was a pleasure. Thank you.